All right, let me throw a number at you. That number's 8. Hi there, it's Matthew Blades, and welcome to another episode of Learn From People Who Lived It. If you're a teacher or you have kids in some sort of a school system right now, today's episode is exactly for you. So that number 8 represents the percentage of teachers that say they feel little to no stress on the daily. So some simple math tells you that north of 90% of all of the teachers out there right now are stressed out. We know that almost half of teachers are walking away from the profession after just 3 to 5 years. That seems like a lot. It is a lot. I think about my own radio career. I can't imagine walking away after just 3 years. I was just getting started. And yet what's happening inside school systems right now is so bad, so toxic, so awful that they just throw their hands up and they say, I can't do this anymore. There has to be a solution. And today's guests have a solution. I'm so excited for you to listen to this episode with Polly and Anika. What they're doing inside school systems is nothing short of incredible. They're taking places that are faced with what seems like insurmountable systemic issues, and they're making a difference. Sit back and enjoy and learn from people who are living it today on Learn From People Who Lived It.
Find Learn From People Who Lived It wherever you get podcasts. Search it using all one word, Learn From People Who Lived It.
Welcome to another episode of Learn From People Who Lived It.
Well, I want to welcome everybody to a really special edition of Learn From People Who Lived It. Can it be special if I say that every time? Yes, of course it can. Because as you all know, I am huge in this space of burnout, and specifically as it relates to teachers. Why? Well, because when you stack them up against maybe healthcare workers or some of the other fields, they're at about a 44% burnout rate, which is insane to me. That tells me that almost half of all of the people that are teaching our kids are experiencing burnout on the daily. That cannot exist anymore. We cannot accept that, because without healthy teachers, we'll never get to healthy kids. So at least that's the way I feel about it. And I have a sneaking suspicion that the two joining me today are maybe not identically aligned with that, but they're pretty damn close. So I want to welcome to our podcast, Anika Costa and Polly, Dr. Paul Gavani. But you prefer Polly, correct?
Yeah, Polly's good.
All right, man. Well, listen, guys, welcome to the pod. How are you today?
Good, wow. Man. How you doing?
Awesome.
That number's way higher, by the way, man. We actually have data that says 92% of teachers, or only 8% of teachers report that they have low stress and high coping strategies, you know? So most are stressed. The 44% is the number of teachers that are leaving the field in 5 years. You might have data that says something else, but we have it's a churn out there, man. It's not good. It's not just teachers, school leaders are leaving the same school within 3 years, right? Being sent to another school after not being successful. And now it's superintendents within 3 years, they're moving on. And nobody's leaving after they've been successful, right? This is after being unsuccessful. And to your point, you know, to bring out the best in the students, we got to bring out the best in teachers. To bring out the best in teachers, we got to bring out the best in school leaders. It goes up the chain, but it's just like this wheelhouse of just blame game that goes down, and it's terrible, man. What's more important to our nation than education, right?
Yeah. Well, a lot of people just don't seem to see it that way, which is so frustrating to me. And I love that we're having this discussion. You all don't know this about me, but I was a terrible student. Not in the sense that like I got in a ton of trouble or anything like that, although I did have my hits along the way, but I had a very different learning style. And in the 80s and early 90s, nobody gave a shit about that. And so it was kind of a one size fits all operation. And so now the fact that like all these years later, I'm leaning into education and trying to do whatever I can to be a resource for teachers and educators is interesting to me. It's not something I would have ever told you 20 or 30 years ago that I would be into. Anika, I'm going to start with you. How did you get to know Polly, and how did you get into this field? And you know, why did you arrive at this place where you two have written a book together called Quick Wins, which we will indeed discuss?
Yeah. So I met Polly about 7-8 years ago now, I think. And I am a behavior analyst, but I'm also a former classroom teacher, so educator. I've held a variety of positions in schools. I've been a classroom teacher. I've been a teacher mentor. I've been an instructional coach. So I have a lot of different, I've held a lot of different positions in education. And how I landed in behavior analysis was interesting because I started out as a speech therapist. And I started as a speech therapist in a school, and I didn't really love the speech part, but I love working with the students. And I come from a family of educators. My parents are both educators. My mom's retired 45 years. So I got a pedigree. My dad, higher education, he retired as a dean. And so my aunts, my uncles, my grandparents, all in education. So it's kind of like in my blood, you know? And I said that I would never become a teacher. So that's how I landed on speech as a speech therapist. And I went to grad school for education in New York, and I needed a job. And so I went to the big book of jobs at the university, and I found a school for developmental disabilities. They were looking for a speech therapist, and I said, okay, I'm going to apply for this job. I was hired pretty much on the spot, and that's where I discovered behavior analysis. So applied behavior analysis. And I fell in love with the science and ended up going further in my career, holding a bunch of different positions in that space as a behaviorist, as a behavior practitioner, and now a behavior consultant.
Love it. Polly, how did she come into your world and how did you get to this point where you were at?
Well, for me, I came into social work first and I love helping people. It's my passion. And I stumbled across somebody who said, hey, you can, you know, like Anika, I was broke. And somebody said, you can get paid like $50 an hour if you go take this course. And I thought it was like crisis management or something. And so I went down and took it. I'm like, holy mackerel, this is incredible. It's the way I kind of thought the world operated. And so I really embraced it. I went into the schools wanting to make a difference out there. And man, there was a lot of challenges. You know, I'm like, what am I going to do with all this stuff? It was nuts. But, you know, I'm sure we'll get to that stuff. But now, kind of fast forward 10 years later, and I was working in the district as a behavior analyst, and Anika showed up to consult in the classroom for an individual student. And I remember her kind of being on the ground working with the student, and it was a mess. It was chaos there, but she was like the eye of the storm. And, you know, the teacher didn't know what she was doing. They didn't have lesson plans. There was a lot of systematic issues going on. And so that's where we kind of hit it off. She ended up, I went back, I got offered a scholarship to go back my certification. I was certified as a board certified assistant or associate behavior analyst since 2004. And, the Dr. Jose Martinez Diaz, who's a very known person or was a known person in our field, offered me a scholarship and I couldn't refuse it. So when I went back, I had to have a supervisor, and she loves this because I asked her to supervise me with it. And this is where she was consulting. I'd left the school district and she was consulting with the school district, but she was doing now stuff that would be in the realm of what we know as organizational behavior management, which is the science of human behavior as applied to groups, right? And in workspaces. And she was struggling a lot. So as she tells it, these are her words and I'm using, she just broke down during one of our supervision sessions, and I'm really supervising her. Yeah, she was ugly crying.
I was ugly crying. I mean, it was a different, like, people think, you know, we're both behavior analysts and, you know, we have all this education behind us and all this knowledge about, you know, why people do the things that they do. And we, you know, figure out the why and the function of behavior. And, you know, I was an educator, I was a classroom teacher, I had all this knowledge. And then I had my knowledge as a behavior analyst. And when I went into schools as a consultant, these are two very different skills. And I wasn't able to put those skills together, meaning like, okay, I know what to do in the classroom, I know what to do as a behavior analyst, but how do I help and support others doing this, supporting them in this work? And that's where, you know, I was so focused on the things that I knew how to do as a behavior analyst.
The learner with the student.
But how do I make adults do the things that I need them to do to support the students, to help the students, to teach the students? And so that was a skill I didn't have. And so what Polly's talking about is, yes, I was his supervisor. I am a board certified behavior analyst, and you have to be supervised in your clinical hours. And so we kind of struck a deal, because I did. I was really struggling in this role as a consultant. I would walk into these classrooms and I did not know what to do. I'm like, oh God, I look around like, where do I start? And, you know, so I started with what I knew how to do, and that's really work with the learners and work with the staff and kind of be on the ground, roll up my sleeves, because that's what I was good at. And then as Paul and I, you know, worked together and, you know, we began meeting for supervision. One day I showed up to coffee for our session, our supervision session, and I literally broke down crying. I'm like, I don't know what to do here. I am not helping. I am tired. I just don't know what to do here. And he told me, he said, girl, you need systems. So I'm sure we'll talk about what that means. But yeah, I needed help. I needed organizational behavior management. I needed to learn how to apply the science, so the principles of the science of behavior analysis, to groups and organizations. And that's what we do.
I want to say almost out of the gate that, you know, my approach to helping anybody in any industry is control what you can control. And what you can't control is yourself and how you take care of yourself. And I almost feel compelled to let anybody who's listening to us now off the hook, especially if you're in that education system. Like, you've been thrust into a world that's so different now than it was 15 years ago, 10 years ago. Shit, it's so different than it was 4 years ago, pre-COVID, 4 or 5 years ago, pre-COVID. And so if you're struggling, if it's hard, and if you don't know what to do, well, then congratulations. You're in the majority of people who are trying to figure this out. And I love that word systems that you mentioned a moment ago, because it's the truth. We're probably in a place where we need some new systems. So I just want to let educators off the hook a little bit and say, like, yeah, if you're struggling, you're not alone. There's a lot of people that are struggling. And so perhaps today's conversation can offer you some context, can offer you some tools, can offer you a little bit of that, oh, geez, yeah, me too. And yeah, that's really my main motivation as we jump into this today, is to let teachers off the hook. So maybe we kind of start there and we say, what's different for educators and teachers and people that are in the classroom today than it was just in like 2020, just in like, yeah, 2019, right?
Well, I want to double down. I want to double down what you're saying there about teachers and just give them such kudos. I don't know what is more important than educators. They are the backbone of our nation. If we're going to reduce poverty, reduce welfare, improve mental health, improve quality of life, and all sorts of other metrics, improve our economy. It's teachers, and they're not supported. They're not prepared the way that they should be prepared. They're, mm-hmm, dropped very much. I'm a professional fight coach, as I mentioned offline. It's like me dropping my fighters into the cage or ring, and they're trying to fight. They don't have the skills to do it. They're taking a beating. We're evaluating them, and they just get burned out, and they end up leaving. And so, you know, unfortunately, you know, this keeps happening again and again, but it doesn't have to be that way, as what you meant. It does not have to be that way. We've seen drastic improvements in retention, student achievement, quality, climate surveys going up. Like, we can't change people's genetics. We can't change their learning history, but we can change the environment around them, right? So the same thing we want for the teachers to do with the students to change the environment, we want the school leaders to do for the teachers and the district leaders to do for the schools, and it can be done.
Want to add to that, Anika?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I mean, I was in the classroom I gotta think back, in 2002, I guess it was, when I was teaching, and I see a tremendous change. And I think, you know, education really hasn't caught up to, you know, how our students operate now in their environment, right? Things are very different. They have access to tools and technology that, you know, is hard to compete with in the classroom. And so I think that's part of the reason. But as Paulie mentioned, a bigger part is the fact that, you know, they aren't prepared. And I've been fortunate, extremely lucky, and I know this is not the experience of most people, most educators. My teacher prep program was actually pretty fantastic, and I had a great cooperating teacher. And so I, along with my cooperating teachers, where I did my student teaching, I had a great experience in both of those, in that practicum. And then also had my mom, you know, I grew up in a classroom, you know, I it's kind of like in my blood, ingrained, you know. And I think most people don't have that experience. And you have people who are coming out of field. So people who don't go to teacher prep programs, they don't attend those programs, they don't learn how to be teachers, they don't even get theory, you know, they don't even get pedagogy. And so because of that, and those who do, who don't get that classroom management training, they don't know how to meet the demands of their job, they struggle. they struggle. And people think like, oh, I'm going to teach some kids. It has to be highly structured. That environment has to be highly engineered. It's its own ecosystem with a bunch of different processes running through it that have to be taught, and it has to be managed, and it has to be reinforced.
Yep. And if we want to double down on that as well, because teaching is complex, it's engineering all day long. That's why I have such respect for good teachers. Most of the teachers that are leaving, there's three main things that they cite. One of them is a lack of support, perceived lack of support from school administration. And it's even worse for them. I've taught in higher education and leadership. Anika teaches as well. But for the school leadership, and it's like theory does not generalize. I can't give my fighters theory and expect they're going to be able to perform in the cage of the ring. That's not the way learning happens. And leaders can impact student achievement by up to 32%, I think, or 34%, some of the latest data that I've seen, right? One person getting them to move in that direction. The other issues are feeling unprepared to meet the demands, and the other one is behavioral challenges. It's all linked, right? Because good leadership is going to create this environment that's going to get the best out of teachers. But it's a struggle. The other thing is to focus on this high stake testing, and yes, it's a terrible thing. They should be focusing on learning. And when everything is about the grade, instead of, you know, one of the things that should be about is like social validity. For example, you know, do students feel safe and cared for and supported? Do teachers feel that way? That should be a grade. That should be something we're measuring regularly and reinforcing people, because school leaders will come out and, you know, people who don't know better will put the whip on teachers and they'll get that grade. But that's not sustainable, right? They do it at the expense of morale. They do it at the expense of sustainability, of creating a love for learning. We don't have that because they're pushing for this all, you know, great grade of how we're measuring success of education. And there are many other factors. Don't we want people to be like, you know, ready for the world and for living, not just to get this grade? A lot of the information being learned isn't necessarily what they're going to need in their life. So I think what we're teaching, how we're teaching, how we're measuring, you know, how we're grading the schools, it needs to change, man. Students shouldn't even know that they're being assessed. It should just be something feedback that allows, as a formative assessment, that allows the teacher to make the adjustments they need to so they can give the student the best that they can get. But we're teaching to the mean. That means a couple students in that classroom are in the pace, and there are a bunch of students who are behind and a bunch of students who are above. And the system just doesn't work. There's actually schools right now that use applied behavior analysis called the direct instruction and precision teaching, and they will guarantee students will learn either double to six times their rate, right? And the research is very clear that it works. So we can do things a lot differently, but we don't. Anybody that's listening to this, if they don't believe me, go look up Project Follow Through. It's the largest study ever done in education. It's about direct instruction. So we have the technology to do it, but we're not using it.
So this begs the question, is what we've been doing an outdated model? Is the way that we've been going to school for 100 years an outdated model?
You want to go, or you want me to take that, Nika?
Well, I mean, I think, well, you have to look at the instructional frameworks, right? And so I think, you know, as I mentioned before, we have not kept up with the technology. Education has not kept up with the technology. And also, I think, you know, especially with the pandemic, there's been this, like, you know, and I kind of understand where it comes from, because it's kind of that old school mentality, like, you know, students come to school and they should learn. They should just want to learn because they want to learn. But there are a lot of right? Because they should want to learn, right? But we have to make this an environment where that's exciting, because again, we're competing with all this other outside exciting stuff. So how does that happen in the classroom? Making lessons engaging and, you know, and maybe using that technology in the classroom. How does all that happen? Well, it happens through training. You know, really people aren't prepared on how to do these things, how to infuse this rigor in the classroom and use this technology effectively and make it exciting for students. And so I think in each point in history, like, you know, and it doesn't take a lot. I just remember, you know, as a classroom teacher, I use a lot of cooperative learning in my classrooms. I use center-based learning. You know, we did project-based learning, all these things, thematic units. We had all of these things. And I think something has gotten watered down as the years have gone by. And I think, as Pauly mentioned, with the high stakes testing, that's been the focus. So it's sucked all of the creativity out of teaching. It's that art piece, you know, and even the science piece. Like, people don't understand the why of what they're teaching and why they teach it. You should teach it this way. And, you know, I think education is really, they get excited by the shiny and new, and this thing is going to be the quick fix. And I really think we need to kind of go back to some of those, you know, basic principles of the science of teaching, of instruction. What does that look like? And focus on that.
I think I agree with most of what Anika said, you know, especially about we got to make stuff engaging in the classroom, right? But Anika's coming from it from a view, in my opinion, of somebody who's an excellent teacher. She's actually working on her doctorate right now. She's a master teacher. She loves it. You know, she lives it and breathes it. When we go do our consulting, she can't wait to get in there. On Valentine's Day, she was training and she said, this is like my Valentine's gift, you know, her poor husband. So she has that perspective. I believe that a lot of things, what she said was right. We have competing contingencies. You go to home and you have all this technology and all these reinforcers are coming in constantly, right? Engaging. Then you go to school and you sit there and you look at a book, right? And so that makes it very challenging for the teachers. I think that there's a lot of things that they can be doing more or less or differently, no doubt about it. If they knew better, they would do better, because nobody would be doing the things that we see them do if they knew better, because it's making their job so much more difficult, right? Good people struggling, doing things all the time, we're like, oh, that's creating more behavior for them. This is making so students aren't learning as well. So they could be doing it. I think that the way things are going, we have to like add in technology to take away a lot of the effort that the teachers need to have. We can't expect everybody to be a great teacher the way Anika is, right? Teaching needs to be kind of aimed at what the average teacher should be able to produce good lessons, right? Or people should be able to learn well from the average teacher, because that's what we're going to get. Everybody can't be great. And the measure of teaching is in the performance of the learner, right? The same way we need to do the same thing for school leaders. The measure of the leader performance is in the performance of the teachers, and it all needs to be linked. And so I think one of the biggest things that need to happen, not just only in our field, but in other fields, is simulations, right? All this knowledge, all this theory, and they to Anika's point, they are, like she said, schematic units and all this stuff, like these performance-based scenarios. I think we need to bring in simulations that are like gamifying what's going on in the classroom. So we have to compete what's going on, but not just there. We have to bring it up into higher ed as well, because we need to have a teacher and provide them a simulation with a classroom management, for example, since they're leaving. And, you know, there's little Pauly running around, and little Pauly's a badass and he's doing all sorts of things, and you respond to little Pauly and you experience the consequences safely of that. And that's got to zoom up. And we need that also for like the school leader. And so they need lots of metrics and feedback to let them know what they're doing well, so when they're actually dropped into the classroom or the school, they can perform. My simulation in the fight game is sparring, right? This is how we connect the training environment to the real world. This is where the fighters can slip, roll, produce, get feedback, right? In an environment that it's relatively safe, because it's not the real fight. We've got to prepare people for the real fight better by embedding simulations into the classroom, not just for the students, but for the higher ed and up.
Can I ask you guys, I hate to beat up on people and be like, well, you should be doing this and you should be doing this. I'd rather frame that in like, here's your opportunity to improve. So what are some of the opportunities that teachers have? What are some of those things that you guys have seen that, and again, I don't want to beat them up. So I don't want to say like, what are they doing in the classroom that sucks and they should fix right away? I'd rather say, what are some things that they could be doing that they're maybe not seeing or looking at yet?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And, you know, like Pauly said, I think, you know, people, if they knew better, they would do better, because
right. It
doing some very simple, quick things in the classroom, just arranging the environment in a different way can have a big impact. So, you know, one of the things that, you know, we see when we go out into schools and into classrooms is that there's really no system of how this classroom is operating. And so when there's no system, there's no processes, there's no tasks, or people engaging in certain behaviors where they're meeting certain expectations and those behaviors are reinforced and, you know, it becomes a habit, that's not happening in the classroom. So things like, you know, how students are arriving in the morning. What do they do when they get to the classroom? Is the teacher standing outside waiting for them and greeting them and saying good morning? And there's a warm up on the board, you know, some kind of activity or a response, the writing prompt, something that, you know, they come to the classroom and they're like, okay, I'm ready to learn. I hang up my backpack, I put my homework in the homework bin, I come to my seat, and I get started on my morning work. Very simple way to manage that classroom behavior, right? So just simple things of how you can engineer the environment is not happening. And again, it's not their fault because they're not taught that. You know, again, I had a great experience. I was taught these things of how to do these things when they aren't. And this is fundamentals. This is just what teaching is. It's not like, oh, great teachers should do this. No, all teachers need to be doing this. They need to have good classroom management. They need to have systems that run their classrooms. They need to teach those behaviors and then reinforce them.
Yeah, I want to. I want to double down on that again. Well said, Anika. We need to understand the importance of systems. And so the analogy we like to give is that imagine driving in your area and there are car accidents everywhere, all the time. Cops out there giving people tickets, you sending people back to driving school, suspending license, and even arresting a few because it's happened so many. But when you zoom out, you realize, wait a second, there's no rules of the road. There's no lines in the road. There's no green light, yellow light, red light, stop light. Good systems generate rules that we follow, and they bring behavior into what we call stimulus control. Nobody's coming out to tell you to do this or do that in the area that you live because you know. You just use the cues in the environment to let you know, right? Because your behavior is getting reinforced, which the last thing Anika said was about reinforcement. Reinforcement, people don't understand what real reinforcement is, right? There's been some books out, Punished by Rewards by Alfie Kohn and some other stuff where they like really kind of shit on reinforcement. There's 100 years of science that supports the things that we do, right? People think reinforcement is about coming out and giving people like a reward or a praise or a token or a Skittle or whatever stickers. It is, right?
Yes.
Right. And it can be, right? The reinforcement is just a stimulus that's added as a result of a behavior. And if it's a positive, right, which just means added, it's going to keep that behavior going. The ultimate reason to use any of that stuff, right, is to get people to want to learn. If you love the math, if you love the reading, that's the reinforcer. You're doing it because it's producing a valued outcome for you. So the best thing a teacher can do is create an engaging lesson that's challenging to the student and they're fired up by that. You don't need anything else. But if the student doesn't like math, if there's not a love for math, a love for the reading, for whatever reason, then we connect the dots with extrinsic stuff, right? Our praise, you know, the grades, or other things, because maybe our praise isn't reinforcing them to them if we haven't established ourselves as somebody of value. Because like Anika said, we're not greeting them at the door. We're not recognizing the things that doing right a lot more than correcting behavior, or we're not correcting it in a way that is private and preserves their dignity. I mean, think about it. You don't want to be corrected by your leader publicly, right? It's embarrassing, and you're not going to be around those people. So we zoom out with that, and that very thing we need to use for teachers. Like a lot of school leaders, too often they walk around, they catch people being bad, right? Instead of systematically reinforcing them from making improvement. And this creates an environment, because you talked about earlier about people burning out. From a behavioral perspective, burnout means you're not getting in touch with positive reinforcement. That's what that's about. And leaders, classroom leaders, are responsible for getting their students in touch with that. School leaders are responsible for getting their teachers in touch with that, and district leaders, school leaders. But people don't understand what this stuff is, and they put way too many demands on people, and they're not helping them. So our approach is, when we go in and we look at systems, we try to find these quick wins, right? And these things that are easy for people to do that produce visible and valued outcomes, right? Valuable to them, not us, to them. And when they do that, they're like, oh, you know, they bind to us, or they bind to the leader, and it creates a want and value to do more because they believe in these processes. And too often, people are wanting to make change and they're dumping a whole bunch of stuff. Like a quick one in the classroom, if we wanted the teacher to bind to the classroom management system, we don't try to change the whole day. We change one transition, right? If it's a whole school, you don't try to change the whole school. You change one, the arrival time, one hallway, and you show people that it can be done because all the principles are the same. You just wash, rinse, and repeat, right? It's all grounded in the science of human behavior. But people need to understand what this thing about positive reinforcement is. And by the way, people use negative reinforcement to drive behavior. Negative reinforcement in terms of performance improvement is fear of consequences, right? Now, here's the problem with that. When's the one time that you definitely do the speed limit? When's the one time you for sure do the speed limit? It's when,
yeah, when there's cops around, right?
Right. That's because your behavior of doing the speed limit is under contingency of negative reinforcement. Now, you might do the speed limit in other areas where it's beautiful and you're in a foreign area and you're copping all this positive reinforcement, the sights and the sounds and smells. It's beautiful, right? But in the performance world, we've got to set people up. We need to involve them, right? If they author their own it, we need to help them see, align their behavior with the results, right? And we use data to not punish. You never use data to punish. We use data to reinforce. And we don't have these things like climate surveys at the end of the year. That's a freaking autopsy. You want to talk about mental health issues, right? And improving that stuff. Let's check in with our people to see how they're feeling. And we do that regularly, monthly. When we go into schools and doing school turnaround, we look at it weekly, right? And we respond to that stuff because it's not about our intent. It's about our impact. And so we should be using that to respond to our followers, right? But also that data should be used by coach, not to punish the leader, the classroom leader, the school leader, but to shape their behavior, to coach them, to let them know what they're doing well and the things that they can do to be better. And we use this data collectively, we start to shape and change the environment. And now we get teacher retention, improve quality of performance, improve mental health, improve student achievement, all these things improve. But people need to understand how to leverage this very important concept of positive reinforcement through the science of human behavior.
This is such a great conversation. I have so many people that I need to put you in contact with here in the Phoenix area that are doing incredible work around teacher retention and in the classrooms and just how they want to pour into teachers in general. And one of the things that I'm thinking about as you guys are talking about all this is I've been a hockey coach for 22 years or something like that. And I would consider myself to be a very progressive hockey coach. There's the old school and then there's the new school. And I'm definitely a lot more in the new school. I see some pieces of merit with the old way, but mostly I think it sucks and I'm interested in where we can go moving forward. And I'm listening to you guys and I'm thinking, oh my God, there's so many parallels to everything you're saying. Like just starting with one thing. Well, that's weight loss. You want to lose 40 pounds? Just add water to your diet and then watch, you know, like start habit stacking from there and see what happens. You want to improve your high school hockey program? Well, then get people to love coming to practice and coming to games and build community where they feel like this is where they want to be. And the example that I give all the time when I speak is we used to have this kid who didn't want to come to practices and he only would show up for the games. And we had an old school coach who was like, I'm gonna light this guy up. I'm freaking done with him. I want to scream at him. And I was like, whoa, how about if we just tell him how incredible he is and how awesome our team plays when he's there? Why don't we just tell him how much we love the energy that he brings to our practices? And we feel like when he's here, he elevates us to no end. Let's tell him that. And we did. And he started coming to practice because he felt important. He felt valued. He felt like somebody who needed to be there all of a sudden. And if we had gone down that road of screaming at him, what do you think would have happened? Like, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to figure that out. He would have wanted to come even less. And it sounds like these are some of the same things that you guys are helping and trying to put into school. So You've written a book together. It's right here on, I just covered myself up if you're watching us on YouTube. It's called Quick Wins, Using Behavior Science to Accelerate and Sustain School Improvement. I'm guessing that each one of you has contributed to certain parts of this story. And so, Pauly, I'll turn to you first. What's one of your favorite chapters in this book and why?
Well, I think it's probably like the origin story. And that is, when I first walk into a school, it was my first turnaround school, and it was crazy. It was brand new teachers, a brand new administration, and brand new student body because they decided to stop busing. The school actually had been under a court order for desegregation since the early 70s. It was now like 2003. They decided to change it in 2006. They redid the school. They wanted to be a community school. And everybody was well-intended, but they clearly nobody looked at the research about diversifying the socioeconomic makeup of schools. So they put in that the school was a high poverty area, high crime rate area. And I came out about 3 months into the school year. I was assigned to a classroom just to help the class out. And I parked the car, walked up into the breezeway in the where the kids are arriving off the buses. And there's about a 100-yard walk to the cafeteria. And there were no adults in the breezeway. Now, this is an elementary school. Can you imagine the chaos that was going on there, how overly aroused the kids were going. They're running up and down, pushing each other's fights going on. It was crazy. There were no teachers in the hallway when I was walking into the classroom. I remember at the end of the day leaving and, you know, the bell rang, and the bell should not be, the bell does not dismiss students. Teachers should dismiss students, right? You land the plane slowly. Kids would just run out and the same thing. That year, the school went from an A to an F. They were getting over 50 calls a day to remove students from the classroom. They had 792
50 a day?
Yes, in a school with 600 and X students, right? And so at the end of that year, the school, the deputy superintendent came to me and said, you know, hey, Paulie, we're going to try to turn the school around. Do you think you can help out? And I thought to myself, hell no. What am I going to do with this place, man? It's crazy. Right. But while I didn't believe in myself, I always did believe in the science of human behavior. And so the school had been trained in this stuff called school-wide positive behavior support, or positive behavior support, intervention support. Have you heard about that before?
No.
It's a systematic approach, right? So that's good, some data on it. But and it was about, you know, recognizing, teaching kids skills and being positive and recognizing, building relationships. But I thought to myself, well, man, you know, if we're going to bring out the best in students, don't we got to bring out the best in teachers? Shouldn't we have some sort of positive behavior intervention support for the teachers? And I said that to a colleague. And they said, you know, there is something like that. It's called organizational behavior management. And they handed me a book by the guru in this field, Dr. Aubrey Daniels. And I read it and I thought, this is all the stuff I already know. It just is being applied at organizational level. And so I came out that next year and I didn't know where to start because it was too big. And it was so big. Like, how do you change around a whole school? And so selfishly, not because I read some research, I thought this is the way to go and I was being strategic. Selfishly, I decided to address that arrival time, right, where I saw where I first came out. And something miraculous happened. That is, once we shaped that up within just a few days, and it didn't take a whole bunch of things, people believed they could do it, so they got self-efficacy. They believed that if they did it, they could produce the outcome. They got response efficacy. They valued that outcome. So it made them value me and it made them value the science, right? So we took it on the road. We did some other things. And that year we went from, instead of 50 calls a day to the classroom, by the end of the year, we had 3 calls a week. We went from 792 suspensions to 67. The school only made it up to D because that's a long way to drop, right? But they started moving in the right direction and we took that show on the road. So that's my favorite story in that, because it sets the tone for how we discovered quick wins and how using this stuff can make a real positive difference.
All right. What about you, Nick? Same question. And I should say the title of the book is brilliant because everybody does want the quick fix. I haven't read the whole thing here, but I'm going to assume that, you know, some of these fixes, they did actually take a little bit of time to implement. But the idea that it can be a quick win is exciting. And so, Anika, same question for you. What is one of your favorite chapters to write about in this book?
So I did a lot of work around the questions and the reflection and, you know, some of the tools in there. Just as we kind of went back and refined them. And I think I really don't have a favorite chapter, but I think throughout, just getting people to reflect on, you know, things that they've done and things that they might try. And, you know, hopefully that this, the reflections, the questions that we're asking at the end of each chapter, like, spark them to get out and
think about something. Learning. She wants
I'm
to
about
learn
learning.
It.
Yes, I want you to learn from it. And I love the tools that we have in there to give people. I love eating tools. One of our clients just called me the guide and goodie giver because I love giving out tools. So yeah, I think for me.
Well, you like the PDC. That was one of your favorite tools.
Yes, one of my favorite tools, the PDC, which is the Performance Diagnostic Checklist. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, Paulie, you know, turned me on to was the PDC. And it's just an amazing tool because it can be modified to fit the environment, the setting, the folks you're working with. It can be used as a self-reflection tool. It can be used as a supervision tool. It can be used as a checklist, a guide for you to see, hey, where am I? You know, do I have all of these things in place? It looks at performance issues in terms of a skill deficit or motivational deficit. So it's can't do or won't do. And it helps you tease out, you know, what those performance issues are. And, you know, you have to have certain things in place. Like, do people have the skills? Have they been taught to do these things? Do they have the resources? How often are you correcting behavior? How often are you, you know, reinforcing their behavior when they do the right thing? So all this is part of this diagnostic checklist, which is a fantastic tool. And it's actually in the book. So I love that part of the book is, you know, the learning piece, the tools, and the recommendations, the strategies we offer, they are quick. They don't take a lot of time. They don't take a lot of effort. It's essentially what a quick win is.
And they're not quick. I want to separate from quick fix, right? Quick fixes are things that aren't sustainable. Quick wins are sustainable, right? They're for about initiating change and then sustain it because you're using the behavior science to keep it going. Because when you involve the people, that's a part of the quick win. They're going to take the ball and run with it.
Yeah, people.
I got to imagine that as you guys get into schools, people are so thirsty for this stuff that they just, you know, they're completely leaned in. They're like, come on, help me out. Please tell me what everything you know, because everything you're talking about seems, number one, so commonsensical. Like, it just makes, like, of course that's what we should do. But we kind of, we've gotten away from that. I think a lot of people get in their heads sometimes. A lot of these people have brilliant ideas and they get stifled by bad leaders or, you know, maybe even just their own negative thought process that's kind of cycling in their head. And they think, yeah, it's a great idea, but... You know, and or they've been defeated. Oh, this is going to work. And they tried it one time and it doesn't. So they just throw it away rather than maybe rethinking how they frame it and, you know, different approach to it. So let's go to these leaders in education. If I'm a superintendent, if I'm a principal, what are some of the first things that I should be thinking about, especially if I'm in a school where I know I need some help?
Yeah. Number one, right away, you need to involve your stakeholders, right? You need to find out what's important to them because all results require behavior, right? It requires people behaving. And if you don't get them on board, if you don't find out what's important to them, what they value, if you don't find this quick win, right, to get them to believe themselves and believe in you, and you haven't been going around and strengthening your relationship with them just by listening, right? Just by listening to them, talking to them, letting them know that you want to find out what's important to them. What you're going to do is you're going to end up being coercive towards them. You're going to use negative reinforcement or fear of consequence because they're not going to do the things that you would like them to do at the level. Because if you think about it, we have to use perspective taking all this, right? If you can imagine going in, sitting in a classroom all day long, for example, that you're bored with, you know, like nobody wants to be trained that way. If your leader is coercive to you, if when you show up in the morning and you go into that parking lot and you see their car, you feel sick to your stomach, that's not going to get you the best that we're not going to get the best out of students. We have too many people saying, do it for the students. You cannot make it about the students without making it about the faculty and staff. And you can't make it about the faculty and staff without making it about the principal, right? Because a lot of district leaders are jumping on the school leaders, and school leadership is very difficult. The management ratios are way off, right? These are some of the great, good school leaders are some of the greatest leaders that we have in the world because it's so challenging. I have so much respect for them. They need help. They need resources. They need to be coached on using these tools that we talk about. Because as you mentioned, we make it simple for people because complexity is the enemy of execution, sustainability, and scalability, right? So these things need to be practical, but they still need to be grounded in the science of human behavior. So we need to have involved people, but we also need to have some metrics, right? Where are we right now? Because if we don't know where we are right now, not just with student achievement, but with lots of other things, we're unable to show growth, and we want to show growth to use as a tool to reinforce people, to let people know, look what you're doing. And because you're doing this, we are achieving these results. And it's so powerful. Like when you get on that scale and you see that you know, quarter pound come off because you want to lose weight, it feels so good to see that, you know, or your pants fit a little bit looser because that's the goal you're shooting for or whatever. That little bit of movement becomes such a powerful positive reinforcement for you. It keeps your behavior going. And you said it earlier, it's about habit development, right? We got to get people in the habit. So you got to find the key habits. And this is why we want to have good systems, because systems guide our behavior. Just like as a coach, you know, you have systems. There are drills. You got to put on your leading hat. You inspire them, right? You got to put on your training hat to make sure they have the skills. You got to put on your coaching hat. And that's where you switch to asking, what are they doing? What impact are they having, right? So we're generalizing the skills. And then you got to put on your managing hat sometimes. And that's making sure that people are doing the things that they need to be doing, right? That's the maintenance. And so classroom leaders need to have those skills. School leaders need to have those skills, and district leaders need to have those skills. But without involving your people and having a metric, none of that stuff matters, right? Because nobody wants those things done to them, right? They want things done with them. And this is like critical to success.
Okay, Nika, because you've been in the classroom most of your life, I'm going to ask you, I asked him about, you know, sort of leadership and principles. What can teachers start doing? What could teacher listening to this today start doing tomorrow?
Well, it's exactly what leaders should be doing, and it's involving the students. to involve the students. And you have to build relationships. And I think that's an important thing to talk about. You know, people, again, you know, think students come to school, they should learn. Kids go to school, they need to come and they need to learn. But we also need to respect them. We need to build a relationship with them. We need to help them know that they are safe and cared for in this environment. School is a safe place. It's a good place to be. And it starts with something very simple, which is asking questions. Hey, how was your night? How was your weekend? What's going on? You look a little down today. What's up? You know, saying hello. We've been in schools and it still blows my mind. And it makes me actually very, quite sad. We were, you know, I think we were doing an assessment, Pauly. I tell this story because it just blows my mind that, you know, we are in the cafeteria and students are lining up and, you know, there's lots of things going on. It was a space that definitely needed some attention. But as the students are waiting for their teacher and, you know, Pauly and I were kind of, you know, we're walking around, we're saying hello and hi, how was your lunch? You know, what'd you have today? You know, we're trying to engage in conversation with these students and some of them, they like, look at each other. They're like wide-eyed, like, oh my gosh, somebody's talking to me. Like, do you know her? Why is she talking to you? These are actual questions from the students. And that's an indication of like, these students, who talks to them? Does any adult talk to them? And it's just very telling. And so that's a big deal. Like, you don't understand how important building those relationships are with students and finding out who they are and what's going on with their life. And also sometimes they come to school with stuff just like adults come to school with stuff. And, you know, I taught in a high poverty, you know, low socioeconomic area, food desert in New York City. And, you know, I would send kids home with food on the weekends because I know like Friday lunch was their last meal until Monday at breakfast. And I just knowing that about your students, understanding who your people are. This is your little classroom. Those students were mine. These were my babies when they were in there, you know, and I was responsible for them. And so I think it's really important that the first thing, the quick win there is building a relationship with your students and including them in that process. So, you know, if we're putting in a classroom management, you're designing your classroom management system as a teacher and you're, you know, trying to figure out consequences. So those consequences to reinforce appropriate behavior in the classroom and setting those expectations and also how to correct misbehavior. You involve the students and have them give their input. What do you think should happen, you know, when we all work together and we're doing the things that we're supposed to be doing? And then have them, you know, take a vote, give you ideas. Okay, let's do that. And what about, you know, when we're not doing what we're supposed to do, if these things happen in the classroom, somebody gets out of their seat or, you know, calls out, what do you think we should do? What do you think I should do? And get their input on that. And they got some great ideas, these students. So I think it's really important to involve them, build a relationship. You know, that's first and foremost.
Classroom leadership.
Yeah, I love this conversation so much. It's literally my approach with my kids in hockey, right? It's sitting them down and saying, hey, new season's here. What do we want our practices to look like? What can you guys buy into? You know, what do you need? Because we practice really early in the morning at 5:45 in the morning, right? And so some of them, it's really, really like you gotta want to be there. And it was, and one of the things, one of the stories that I love to share is similar to yours. I sat my kids down at the beginning of the year. Actually, it was about a month into the season when some were missing practice. And I was like, what the hell's going on? You know, why are we choosing not to be here? Why do we feel like this is optional? And one of the biggest things that came up was people were hungry. Like, what? I would have never seen that coming. But thanks to, like, for asking the question, we invested in some freaking granola bars. And we brought granola bars with us to the high school hockey practices now. And when the kids come in, each one of them, if they want, we give them a freaking granola bar. And that little thing has changed so much in terms of attendance and how many people want to go. And
it was a quick win.
It was a quick win, right? And we're going to keep on doing it. What's so funny is the people who were like, yeah, we're hungry. Yeah, we're hungry. Yeah, we're hungry. Yeah, we're hungry. Eventually, it was like 15 granola bars. Down to 10, down to 8, down to 7. And then there's literally only like six kids that want a granola bar anymore. And it's funny how they perceive this issue or this problem, and then you've solved the issue for them, and it almost goes away. And so this is so electrifying to me to hear this kind of talk, because it's exactly how I think we have to approach it. But there is this fine line of holding people accountable and making sure that we, you know, you mentioned systems, right? And so we even went this far as to ask the kids, what should the punishment be for somebody who misses two practices in a row? Man.
Well done.
What should we do when so-and-so does this? What should we do when these things show up? And we sent a survey out to all of our kids, and they voted on the discipline. Now it's like, this is it. I'm not going to get upset. I'm not going to yell at you. I'm not going to scream at you. You voted on these rules. I'm just executing what you told me to do.
The system does the work for you.
That's it. It's so easy and yet so difficult. As we sort of wind down our time together, and it's clear to me that there's more to do here because, like I said earlier, I have so many folks here locally that I need to make sure that I make an introduction to you because you guys could really be helpful for them. Let's assume that we've got some parents listening to this, and let's assume that we've got the kind of parents listening to this who want to do better, who recognize that teachers are struggling right now, and there's room for improvement, and there's opportunities for growth. What do you think as parents we could be doing? And maybe it's different for elementary versus middle versus high, but are there some common things that we could be doing as parents to help our educators out?
Yeah, well, I'm going to try to frame this through an approach that Anika and I use when we go into schools, and we use this approach whether we work with an individual teacher, whether it's a group of teachers, whether we've actually done it with 250 school leaders in the room. We use something called the ACT matrix, right? ACT stands for acceptance, commitment, training. And it's actually a way to address mental health issues. It's also a way to set goals and move towards that. So I want you to imagine four boxes. This is for anybody listening. And this is grounded in deep research. I'm going to keep it very simple, very practical, but we use it everywhere. We think in this all the time. I teach my fighters how to use it, right? The bottom right-hand corner are your values. And values are a way of being and doing, okay? I like being kind. I like helping people. I love disseminating the science of human behavior. I'm going to give you an example of this. I'm sure parents value their students' learning, right? I'm sure teachers want them to learn. They value positive culture, you know, way of being, doing. What do you want here? So in the bottom left-hand corner are thoughts and feelings and bodily sensations that show up for us, right? Now, these are things that you can't see how I'm feeling and thinking, and I can't see how you are feeling and thinking. But you can observe your own behaviors, your own covert behaviors, right? Your thoughts and feelings are actually behaviors, right? And I'm going to give you an example of myself first, and I'll bring it back, and I won't spend a lot of time on this. I'll bring it back to the parents. I value disseminating the science of human behavior. This is very important to me. Sharing, getting people to adopt the principles, right? Because I know it's the science of helping people help themselves and help others. Really important to me. I used to have a massive fear of public speaking, massive fear. And so in the bottom left-hand corner, when I got invited to speak, I would have all these thoughts or do a training like, oh, I'm going to embarrass myself. I don't know, I don't know this. And so in the top left-hand corner, I would engage in behavior that would allow me to escape these feelings, right? So I'd say, well, no, I'm not going to do this talk, but I'll do the PowerPoint. I'll set up the room. I'll do the research, anything to avoid that feeling, because you know what it feels like. And nobody wants to deal with anxiety, right? So I'd feel instant relief. So I have this value that I want to disseminate. I have this feeling that shows up and it's really bad. I have this stimulus that presented. Can you give a training somewhere? And I'm like, no. And so I engage in this behavior to remove that stimulus. That's actually negative reinforcement. It feels great. The problem is that it's simultaneously moving me away from my values. It's why people get hooked on drugs, right? And drinking alcohol, because a lot of people do it because it's getting rid of some sort of pain. So what's the secret here? Well, cognitive behavior therapists say to change your thoughts, to change your behaviors. And hey, I do it all the time. Oh, you're overthinking this and blah, blah, blah. The problem is when you get hooked, and if you're trying to change your thoughts, it's like holding a ball underwater, right? Where the real deal is that we need to engage in behavior. So we first need awareness. I think this way, I behave that way. That's a misalignment. And I'm aware, because I know my values, it's a misalignment of what I really value. I need to accept that I feel that way, right? Don't try to change it. Instead, focus that energy on behaving. Now, what behaviors are those? In that context, for me, I had to learn how to tell stories. I had to learn how to speak slower. I had to recruit some people like Anika to help me develop better PowerPoints and sequence them well, right? And then as I began to speak, and I did it in small chunks, I would see people leaning in and listening and smiling and looking thoughtful and asking me a question or afterwards telling me that made so much sense. As that, I kept getting in contact more and more with those positive reinforcements. What do you think happened to those feelings? Think they went up or down? They went way down, right? In fact, now if you tell me I'm going to have to do a speech, and Anika and I got up and we had to speak in front of 4,000 people just the other, you know, last year, I'm going to freaking crush it. I can't wait. But it required me engaging in behavior well enough and long enough to produce these outcomes. So what's this have to do with parents? There's so many different behaviors in different settings, right? Like teachers, we'd say, hey, have a good classroom management plan, teach the classroom management plan, observe it, reinforce and correct, right? Involve your students in developing it, right? If you do that, you know, ask lots of questions during your teaching, because that's going to engage the students. And as they produce these outcomes, it's going to produce some sort of habits. In terms of what the parents should do, it's all contextual, right? I can't tell them exactly. I know that I think they should build a relationship with the teacher. I think that's important. I think they should, you know, be involved in the assessment of, you know, taking a look at the student's grade, not just at the report card time, but having the student self-monitor and report out. I personally would have their assessment tied into like, hey, you're doing well. Hey, you got access to the things that you love. You're not doing well. I'm not taking it away, but we know that if you don't do your work, you don't get paid, right? And so it's tied. It's a direct, naturally contingency. Do your chores, you know, do your homework, do those things, right? And I know this is happening because there's a metric that lets me know. The metric is of your learning. And I'm not going to punish you with learning, right? I'm just saying this is something that's important. I value this stuff. And the other things that you love are tied into these things, those alternative things. So I would use the ACT matrix, because parents might get pissed off at their kids, right? They get upset and they engage in things in the top left-hand corner, like they're very punitive and do this, that, and the other, right? And they make students not want to go to school, or they call up the teacher and they blame the teacher. And maybe the teacher should be doing some other things, but it's better to build a relationship with the teacher. So determining what are going to be the most effective behaviors up in that right-hand corner, knowing your values, knowing what shows up with you, knowing the things you shouldn't do, being aware that that's not going to move you towards where you want to go, and identifying a couple key behaviors like I just lined out there. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And so what I'm hearing here, just to isolate one of your thoughts, is the best thing that one of the things that parents can do is, instead of firing off that email about how crappy the teacher is, you say, can we get a meeting and just talk for a second? I've got a couple of things I'd like to address, right? Like, don't put the cart before the horse. Like, as you said, build the relationship.
Yes.
Ask some good questions. What is happening in the classroom?
Those are some key behaviors right there, right?
It's
check
huge.
Check yourself. If you value your student learning, you want to have a good relationship with the teacher, right? You want them to work with you and not work against you. So you're going to have to check your emotions, because, you know, our kids bring out emotion in us, right? Especially if we feel like they're being wrong or something like that. So do it, you know, stay aligned with your values.
Yeah, that's so cool. And I'll give everybody just a real quick example, and then I want to kind of turn to you to answer the same question. We've been dealing with this with our son and his math teacher, and we've just been having a lot of trouble. And we had a bright kid who's just having a hard time in this class. We've got him a tutor, like he's working on we're doing all of the things that we can. And what, through our relationship building with this educator, with this teacher, we found out that there's actually some inconsistencies within the math department. And there's certain teachers doing it one way, other teachers are doing it another way, and another teacher's doing it another way. And through our building of this relationship with this teacher, we've actually, in my opinion, had a positive impact on this school, because these three teachers who were all kind of wandering in their own directions have come together now. And there's a little bit more, to use your word, systems in place.
Yeah. Yes.
It was a systems issue. And so the reward was that. And we're trying, just like everybody else is. And it's just, it's so hard because of what you just said. It's our thoughts that equal our feelings, and then that translates into our behavior. And some of us are
should be what I just laid out in the matrix. all the students should be learning this, right? They should be learning about their values. They should be learning about their thoughts and feelings 100%. And how it impacts their behaviors, right? This should be a regular lesson in class. This should be something the teachers lean into because it's about involving it. Those values in the bottom right-hand corner, you can make those shared values. What are shared values? What collectively shows up for us? What behaviors would we be engaged in that let us know we're not aligned with those values? And what should we be doing? It's so simple, but so powerful.
Okay. Nika, you get the final question here, which is, you know, what can parents and kids be doing to help out this situation? Because as we just said, this is a shared value. We all have some skin in the game and we all have really, this should be our biggest motivation is to get this right so that we can fix some of the systemic issues that are present in the world.
Yeah. I mean, I agree 100%. And I, so kind of what I do in my household, I empower my husband and I, we empower our children to do what we would do as parents. And so if something's not good, I pick up my daughter from the bus stop, you know, every day and we go through the whole series of questions, you know, how was your day? You know, what happened? What exciting thing happened? Nothing exciting happened. Okay, tell me one thing you learned today. And we go through all those questions. So I think that's a big thing, asking questions, right? But also empowering your child to ask questions for themselves. So, you know, there have been times when my daughter came, you know, home and my teacher, she did this and, you know, and this, and she didn't tell us the due date. And then after asking a series of questions, it was like, oh, she didn't really do what she was supposed to do. So I think, you know, students come upset, they get a bad grade or not the grade they want, or, you know, they missed a deadline. Okay, how are you accountable for this? What's your responsibility in this? And then also teaching them to be advocates for themselves, you know, and ask questions of the teacher. And by teaching our children that, and, you know, if something doesn't feel right, it's just go to the teacher in a respectful way. How do you do that? How do you ask those questions to get the help that you need in school? And I think teaching them those skills are very important because, you know, they're there all day. They know the whole backstory. So before we, you know, mama bear is what, you know, I'm totally guilty of that. But before we go there, let's hang back and let's help the children problem solve, because I think that's a big skill that, you know, a lot of kids don't get to develop or practice very often.
Yeah, but as people in your field, wouldn't you rather have the mama bear, the papa bear, than the completely disengaged parent who gives no craps about what's going on once they drop their kids off in the morning? I mean, wouldn't you rather have a parent who's a little bit involved and asks some questions, even challenges you sometimes?
But I would also want to know why that parent isn't engaged. What's going on in that parent's life?
Sure.
Where they're just like, bye kid, you know, drop up now. It's your problem, teacher. I want to know what's going on with that family, because there might be a way that I can help. There might be something that they need that they just haven't been asked the right questions or given the proper support.
Yeah. That's such a great thing to say. I once had a parent challenge me on the coaching, and he said something to me and I was able to flip it on him beautifully. And he said, you know, I just think that everything starts at the top. And I said, okay, I'm with your child for 1.5 hours a week. He lives with you.
Yeah, reflect on that one. Who's really at the top here?
Who's the guy at the top? You want to start at the top? Then go check the mirror right behind you, buddy.
Well said.
Yeah, I mean, honestly. All right. Here's how I view this conversation. You know what? You know, everybody can think of an iceberg right now. And we all have learned that the biggest part of the iceberg is what's underneath the water. And that's how I feel about this conversation. We have only gotten into what we can see. There's so much more to cover. And so this is my way of inviting you back to further this conversation. And then, as I've said numerous times, I'm going to get you guys to Phoenix, because clearly what you know and how you work with people, we have to get this implemented. And for those that can't get to it right there, I'm covering myself up again. You can see quick wins using behavior science to accelerate and sustain school improvement. I love the tic-tac-toe. It's one of my favorite games. If you guys played a game of tic-tac-toe, who would win?
Me, totally. I'm very strategic, very analytical, and very
Paul didn't even argue.
No.
I don't care. She has a difference. She can win. I let her win tic-tac-toe all the time.
Brilliant. Guys, thank you so much for your time today. And I love what you're doing. Keep going. Keep going. Even on the tough days, just keep going.
You keep it up too, man. It sounds like even you don't have to be a behavior scientist to implement good behavior principles. We have people in the world that are just like natural behaviorists. And it sounds like you've captured that, man, because everything that you said, it seems right on board, man. So well done.
Thank yes. you. All right. Appreciate you guys' time. Have a wonderful rest of your week.
Thank you. You too.
We have three goals with Learn from People Who Lived It. One, to help you feel less alone. Two, encourage you to seek out a coach, a therapist, a church, anyone who can help you get through your journey and find some healing. Three, when you're ready, share your story with us.
Find Learn from People Who Lived It, wherever you get podcast. Search it using all one word, Learn from People Who Lived It.
You've probably heard me say this before, but most of the things that kill us are preventable. And that's exactly why I put my heart in his hands, in his care. I'm talking about Dr. Robert Todd Hurst and HealthSpan MD. He's my cardiologist because I appreciate his holistic approach to heart health. There's nothing out there like HealthSpan MD. His AFib reversal program, his CAD reversal program. Get the link on the resources page at learnfrompeoplewholivedit.com.